Steve Chaney, and I'm the CEO of the American Security Project. Welcome to our annual Christmas party. This has been an exciting couple of weeks for us. If you're not familiar with the American Security Project, founded in 2006 by a few senators, Hagel, Kerry, Hart, and Rudman, and Christine Todd Whitman, among others, to have a bipartisan group that would take on topical issues that, if brought up in the ordinary context, were oftentimes painted far left or far right. And we wanted to have a bipartisan group that could discuss these issues and hopefully use a factual basis and discuss them from a national security perspective. So you can tell by those names, we're expecting an exciting week or maybe 2 weeks here with two of my board members maybe headed over to the Pentagon and the Foggy Bottom. A quick couple of ground rules. I'll make some introductory remarks, then we'll have the Honorable Ellen Tauscher come up and speak for Ellen as long as you want. Then afterwards, we'll do a Q&A. I'll moderate the Q&A. When we do the Q&A, I'll pick on who's going to ask the question. Please tell us who you are and then state a question, and don't read a treatise, and we'll be good to go. And hopefully everybody will have a good dialogue going on today's subject. I think most of you know Ellen Tauscher. She just brings a wealth of experience to the national security issues, and we're thrilled to have you here today. Of course, she was Undersecretary of State for Arms Control and International Security, as well as, most lately, Special Envoy for Strategic Stability and Missile Defense. Of course, prior to that, 12 years in Congress, serving on the House Armed Services Committee and Chairman of the Strategic Forces Subcommittee. First woman, I'm told, to be a member of the New York Stock Exchange. Served as an officer of the American Stock Exchange. She has a deep understanding of the challenges that face our country and certainly has made significant contributions on national security issues, was instrumental in passing New START, is very familiar with our relations with Russia and particularly U.S. missile defense policy. So Ellen, we're very anxious to hear your comments about missile defense, the status of U.S.-Russian strategic stability talks. Ladies and gentlemen, Ellen Tauscher, please do this.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Steve. It's great to be here.
Thank you.
I'm happy that that your founders are going to find you gainful employment.
We hope.
In some good places. We do hope. We all hope, I think. I really want to acknowledge my friend and colleague, Terry Lodge. 2 years ago, I was recovering from cancer surgery in the hospital, getting phone calls from Hillary Clinton, John Kerry, other people, basically croaking onto the phone, make them vote, make them vote, make them vote, because I knew we were ready to ratify the New START Treaty. And Terry's efforts were instrumental in our getting the kind of public awareness and a campaign put together to get the 67 votes we needed. We actually got 71. For those that you that like to follow new trends and getting people to be informed of things, we did a very unusual thing for a treaty. We went out and actually sold it publicly. Over the time that I was doing chemotherapy and radiation, I couldn't leave the house, but I could talk to editors on boards of editorial boards around the country. And we went to purple, red, and blue states. We got 100% support. Some that didn't want to write for us didn't write, but those that did write did get 100% support. And the polling just before the Thanksgiving holiday, when we were going into lame duck, showed that we had about 73% of the American people with us to ratify New START, and we got 71 votes. So that's a message for the future for other things that we might try to do, like CTBT and others. A big public campaign is important. Forming people is important. But what's really important is providing the political capital, positive political capital, for the Senate when they need to take a vote. So I'm here today to talk about my past, since I want to make very clear that I'm a private citizen. I'm not in government any longer. I left as strategic envoy on September 1st. I left as undersecretary in February. It was my great honor to have served President Obama and the country as undersecretary and to work so closely with Secretary Clinton and our friends in the National Security Council, the Pentagon, the intelligence community, the so-called interagency, and it was great. It was a great honor. Of course, it was because that no good deed goes unpunished. For the previous 12 and a half years I had been a member of Congress, I was the first member of Congress from the 10th Congressional District, which is the home of the two national weapons labs, Livermore and Sandia, to actually represent them on their committee of record, which is the Armed Services Committee. And I toiled for many years by myself, pretty much, on the Strategic Forces Subcommittee. My dad started calling me Missile Girl about 1999. My mother actually said, "Do you know about the nuclear weapons?" I told her if I told her anymore, I'd have to kill her. Eventually, when we got struck by lightning in the 2006 election, I became chairman of Strategic Forces in January of 2007, where I was happily sitting when I was asked by the President and Secretary Clinton to become undersecretary. As you know, at that time, the Bush administration was coming out of office. We had prepared nothing for the New START Treaty negotiations. We had a treaty that was inconveniently expiring the subsequent December 5th of 2009. So we had to scramble. Great news is we had Rose Gottemuller and a terrific team of very, very enterprising and experienced people in State Department, all things treaty, all things arms control, all things non-pro, and a great team in the National Security Council, and the president that really wanted to move forward and not only reset the relationship with Russia, but use the negotiations of the New START Treaty to help accomplish that. And Terry and other people in the State Department worked in the interagency to make sure that once we got the treaty ratified, once we got the treaty done, which we did after about my being in Geneva for 23 long days with only 7 days of close, we actually got it done, early February, mid-February. In March we announced it, and then we went to the Senate to get it ratified later that year. And it was unfortunate that we had to do it in the lame duck. Senator Kerry and others had done a good job of getting a number of hearings done. We also knew that we needed bipartisan support, clearly, because we needed 67 votes. But we were able to go forward and get it ratified, and it was just a terrific thing. That same day, as I was trying to recover from tough cancer surgery, another one of my bills, Don't Ask, Don't Tell, got passed by the House. So I had an absolute double whammy that day, both getting New START ratified and getting sent to the President, Don't Ask, Don't Tell. So it was a great day. Missile defense, strategic stability, and Russia, all intertwined, all things that I've worked on for many years, starting when I was in the Congress and clearly when I was undersecretary and then as special envoy. Let me just say that there's a lot to be optimistic about. First of all, we had an election last month. It was settled for me, perhaps not for everyone, but it was settled for most Americans that President Obama has another term. And that says that we have the opportunity to move forward on this relationship and to build a relationship that is sustaining, strategic, and that is one that encompasses many, many different challenges. Our relationship with Russia over many years has been one of cooperation on the first floor, fighting on the second floor, dealing with other issues, including trade and many other things on the third floor, dealing with multinational issues on the fourth floor. It's one of those very dynamic, very large P5 relationships that is fundamentally important. A little confession, when I called Hillary Clinton 4 years ago and tried to tell her how important it would be for her to become Secretary of State, I made the mistake of telling her that it was all about Russia. Of course, it's not only about Russia, but in my opinion, it was all about Russia back then, because it was important to have Russia's support both on Iran, on the turmoil in the Middle East, on energy policy, and about moving forward on many different issues, including arms control, non-proliferation. I think that turned out to be true. But now, as you can see, with the advent of President Putin, we don't have the relationship we had even 8 months ago. But I think we do have the opportunity to move forward. My particular position as Undersecretary was to be at my level, working with both Ambassador Kislyak and Deputy Foreign Minister Sergei Ryabkov. We developed a very strong relationship. I also worked with Anatoly Antonov, who had been in the foreign ministry, went over to their version of the Pentagon soon after we got the treaty ratified. So there's a number of very important players. These are really old hands. These are seasoned foreign policy diplomats. These are people that really understand the relationship. All of them have been posted here for many years. They have lots of relationships, including people on the Hill. So this is a sophisticated relationship and one that needs lots of understanding, but also it's one where you cannot allow what's happening on the second floor interrupt what's happening on the fifth floor. So you need a broad relationship with lots of interlocutors and people that can work issues in a way that builds trust and builds understanding. It's also important to hold very tightly to your talking points. Repeating yourself over and over again can be boring for you, but it's very important for others. And I found myself when I came in as Undersecretary and we were working on the phased adapted approach, I found myself repeating myself over and over and over again, both about what EPAA is and what it isn't. Nothing has changed, except the fact that we have gotten all the agreements done in a record time. Frank Rose, who some of you know, worked for me in the House. He was a terrific staffer on missile defense when I was chairman. And I brought him over with me. He's now DAS, working with Rose, and he is a terrific negotiator. But when we announced the phase adapted approach in September of 2009, it was very clear that we had to go out and get these four agreements done. And we had to deploy the radar on the president's timetable. Not an easy thing to do. We did do it. This past May, in the Chicago NATO summit, President Obama and Secretary General Rasmussen announced interim capability, which was basically turning over some of the assets, including the radar, to the SACUR, who's also UCOM commander, as you know. And so we have a phase-adapted approach that has all of its assets negotiated, all of its treaties done, all of its agreements done, and we're now waiting to phase in those different pieces. What we don't have is an agreement with Russia to go forward. But it is something that has highly animated all of our friends in NATO. They all want it. And I think, frankly, some of the Russians do too. They have some concerns about the capabilities of the system in the later years. We've known that from the very beginning. We also have a lot of concern about what Iran is doing. So we not only want a Russia that is helping us by becoming cooperative and working with us and putting some of their assets and becoming interoperable with the system, but we also need a Russia that is helping us make sure that Iran gets neither a long-range missile that can carry a nuclear weapon or the nuclear weapon. And that is a long-term prospect that has been, I think, more successful, but less transparent for people because it's all based on these very intricate sanctions that we have put in place, mostly with our E3 plus 3 partners. So I think that the situation we have right now is a wait-and-see situation. Late last year when President Putin came back into office, everything basically went into a holding mode. We went into our political campaign. Now we're both out of our political campaigns and we can both begin to talk. And I think that's a fundamentally important opportunity for us. We've made some very things very, very clearly. We're not going to change either our deployment strategy, our timetable, or what we will deploy because of the Russians. On their part, they want more confidence and understanding as to what we're going to do in the later years. We want more help with the Iranians, and we want to be sure that Europe, which is a key ally to us, not only Europe writ large, but our NATO allies, but that Russia understands that we want them to be part of European security. Russia is a huge European player. We want them to turn and be part of European security. If you're going to be part of European security, then you have to understand that NATO allies have real and growing concerns about what the Iranians are doing. Not only because we know what the Iranians are doing, but because we hear what the Iranians are saying. So if you want to be part of European security, then you have to share your colleagues and your neighbors and regional players' concerns about what the Iranians are doing and help us create a security umbrella in this kind of missile defense strategy that we put together. Unfortunately, for those people that didn't believe that missile defense was possible or worth the investment, there's nothing better than what's happening in the Middle East right now to prove to them that missile defense does work. And that the kind of networking that we do, the regional networks that we put together, both for the sensors and for the operational missiles to deter and defend, is a tremendous opportunity for people to get a friend and to find a way to create a missile defense strategy that works for them. The hardest thing would be for someone in the third row to shoot me straight in the face. That would be very difficult for me to defend. But Terry probably is the best person to defend me because she's sitting on the side and you can see the arc and the azimuth. And that's why missile defense is really a networked system of sensors and deployed assets where it's best to have friends that are working in cooperation with each other. Both the Middle East and the Far East are big opportunities to open up a worldwide network of missile defenses. That kind of cooperation breeds the kind of contentment and the kind of transparency that gets people to feel that they actually know who you are and what you're doing. We believe in cooperative agreements. We believe those agreements that really put people on notice that they're meant to protect somebody nearby really creates the kind of environment where people are less suspicious and less worried about what's going on. We think the Middle East is a perfect place for that. You all can think of a few countries that have better relationships with each other than they did even 10 years ago. And they are perfect examples of countries that can work together cooperatively on missile defense. Obviously, missile defense is both tiered and layered. Different assets apply for different reasons. And you know that NATO just put Patriots in Turkey for point defense to protect against the situation that is, unfortunate situation that has developed in Syria. So I could go on about more about the talks, my aspirations for more talks in arms control with the Russians, my hopes that we will work cooperatively on cyber and many other things. I think that we have a very grand and very important relationship with the Russians that will come forward now that the political environment has settled down. I wish the president and his team all the luck in the world. I will be watching it from the side as a citizen, but one that is significantly interested. I do sit as vice chair of the Scowcroft Center at the Atlantic Council, so it's not like I've gotten completely away from it. And I also sit on the board of governors of both the Livermore National Laboratory and Los Alamos National Laboratory. So while I don't do national security every day, I do it as an avocation and as someone who wants to stay deeply involved and interested from the private sector. So I'm happy to answer any questions, Steve, that you might have or any questions that our friends have. And once again, it's great to be here. I wish you all a happy holiday and a Merry Christmas. And I'll answer any easy questions you have.
No one thinks. Yeah, any easy ones. I'm going to take the privilege of asking the first question, if I may. And first, let me say thank you for your service, both in Congress and in state. Not an easy job, and certainly we appreciate your staying with the subject now. You're obviously a subject matter expert, which ASB supports. But you mentioned perhaps the future now that Putin's in place, our president's been reelected. There obviously, I think, a window of opportunity here that if they start on it early, maybe we can make some progress with a number of issues, not the least of which might be perhaps a follow-on to New START. When you look at the fiscal cliff and the money we spend on nuclear weapons, maybe a reduction lower than the 1550. So I'd be interested in your thoughts about that and what you think the probability of making more progress with Russia is.
The Russians do not appear to be at all interested in a follow-on to the New START agreement. They made that clear during the negotiations, which I think we all consider to be unfortunate. I think that the bilateral channel between the United States and Russia on arms control is where all the action is. It really isn't anything else. I think many people want us to move to a multilateral approach to arms control, but I think we need at least one more round ourselves. But of course, the president isn't precluded. I'm not suggesting he would do this, but he's not precluded from doing unilateral reductions on his own. I don't perceive that would happen until the Iranian situation is settled, and I don't believe that would happen until later in his term if we were not successful to get the Russians back. Part of what I worked on with the Russians is a term that I coined called mutually assured stability, which is the bridge between where we have been, mutually assured destruction, to what the future can look like. And it is the framework for a cooperative relationship where we clearly have more of a sense of trust,
more of a sense of understanding where each other are strategically, what our regional issues are, where we are with Europe, what does that mean, and has Russia moving toward a European security environment where they are a partner. And so, I think that mutually assured stability is a worthwhile goal. I think it is a characterization of the relationship that is much more healthy than it has in the past. But we have some elements that we have to achieve to get there. And one of them clearly is to understand how we're going to deal with missile defense and what the Russian role might be in a cooperative agreement and how they actually would play in that. Would they put security assets such as sensors, because they're farther downrange, of course, closer to the Iranians, that would be very helpful. And how do they come into the shared command and control, and how would they do that in a way that at first would not be, would have two triggers, basically. Our missile defense system is so robust that we actually can write out things. If we, you can't be sitting with a glass of water and have somebody tap you on the shoulder and say, we just had a shot launched. And you're not going to be putting down your glass of water and kind of sit and think about what you might do. Mm-hmm. These things are all pre-programmed. They're already war game. They've already been exercised. Everybody kind of knows, because you've got minutes and seconds to make decisions. So it's pretty much decided. And so we need to have the kind of confidence with the Russians that we understand exactly how we're going to take what is our own system and deal with their assets, have separate command and controls that sometime over the future, I believe, probably in 20 years, can become one system when there is a lot more confidence in the relationship and there's a lot more sense that we are not dealing with dualities, but we are dealing with a sense of European security in a very obvious and very agreed way. So I think it's important that we try to understand how to go forward, but the political decisions haven't made, so let's get people to the table.
You bet. All right, remember my rules on questions. Please state your name and keep it short. Yes, ma'am.
On missile defense negotiations.
And your name, please?
Russia. Rachel Oswald, Global Security Newswire. Could you discuss what you think the possibility is of the Obama administration sharing the velocity burnout data of the SM-3 interceptor? It had been previously reported the Defense Department was considering this, but then political furor in Congress kind of tamped that down. And then separately on that same line, the Pentagon announced it was delaying by up to 9 months the development contract for the SM-3 Block 2B interceptor, which was the one the Russians really object to. Do you think it's possible in the missile defense cooperation discussions that the Obama administration might say, we're just going to put that off for a while because Iran has not been assessed to be advancing at its long-range ballistic missile development in the new CRS report?
I'm going to take them in reverse order. The reason the 2B was delayed was because the Senate took the money away. So, no money, no go. So that's one problem. I'm not going to discuss what anybody's strategy is for discussing things. What we've made very clear is things that are classified remain classified in our conversations, even though I think that some people work overtime and want to think about things like secret deals. We're all American patriots. We're not interested in doing things that are either against the law or are going to harm our country in any way. So there is no secrecy about the negotiations, and there's no plan on giving things to the Russians that they shouldn't have. So the Pentagon will make those decisions. But if something can be known to the Russians, then they're going to know about it. But the whole issue of whether the SM-3 is on track or not is really about congressional funding, and they cut it last year, and that's why it's been delayed. And I think that the administration's intent is obvious, because it's in the FYDP that SM-3 is meant, Block 2B is meant to go forward.
All the way in the back. You're going to have to speak really loud.
Hi. I was wondering if you might have any insights as to what President Obama specifically was referring to and what President Putin was referring to.
No, I'm not clairvoyant.
Yes, sir, up front.
Tom Colina, Arms Control Association. Alan,
Tom,
great to see you again.
So good to see you.
You mentioned that the Russians are not interested in the next round of arms reductions. Part of that, not the only reason, is because of their concerns about the European missile defense deployment. And knowing that you're not going to get into, you know, future negotiations, but given your previous role and given that you're, as you say, a private citizen now, what might you think would be a possible way to square the circle? So you've got Russia that needs to be to feel reassured about what the U.S. is doing. If the treaty ever gets done and gets back to the Senate, you need to reassure Republicans in the Senate that Obama hasn't given away the store on missile defense. So how do you, how would you advise the president to thread that needle, if you were, to reassure Russia and the Senate at the same time? And in that vein, I would just ask your thoughts on the National Academy of Sciences report from September, which talked about not doing phase four of the EPAA and doing an East Coast deployment here in the U.S. Does that play at all into your thinking about what might move this issue forward? Thank you.
Well, you know, I cannot predict what the new environment will be, although I'm optimistic, as I said, you know, on the policy side. Now that we have the political environment settled, President Putin, President Obama, you know, I think it's important to allow the president, when he gets his new Secretary of Defense and his new Secretary of State, to be able to, perhaps in the State of the Union address, put forward something that will create the framework for what his ambitions are for his second term. I think we all know that President Obama came in to office, and certainly in his Prague speech, was very animated about nuclear weapons. He has spoken eloquently about the prospect of nuclear zero, but he has made it very clear that he does not believe it will happen either in his lifetime, and it will take patience and persistence. So he is someone who made it very clear very early on and used political capital to do so, that he wants to have a cooperative relationship with Russia, and he wants to have a nuclear arsenal that is both safe, reliable, and certifiable, but one that is not so large, not so expensive, and eventually he wants to get rid of nuclear weapons. So I think the question is, you know, what do we do to settle the issues that will cause the Russians to come back to the table? Missile defense, I believe, is a part of their narrative, but I don't believe it is the totality. The Russians, I believe, and I think most people believe, are over-dependent on their nuclear forces because they have a less robust conventional force and other things. So their equation, where they put a lot of their stock, is frankly in their nuclear weapon capability. So there is a dovetail, clearly, with missile defense. And what does missile defense do to degrade their capability? And we have asserted, and that's why sticking on talking points is important, we have said this consistently, there's nothing about our system, which is a limited system, which is targeted toward the Middle East, which clearly does not have any kind of robustness. It would only chase the tail of Russian ICBMs. You could put it on top of it, it would still only chase the tail. So where it's located, move it this way, do it that way, all of that is obfuscation. It does not solve the problem that we have, that our system is not robust enough to hold their nuclear arsenal at risk, period. So we keep saying it. Some of them believe us, some of them can't believe us, and some of them won't believe us. I think the won't is a small part of it. I think that those that can't for political reasons because they don't really want to come to the table and be in a place where they're going to go below 1550, and we have 7 years to get there, and we're almost there now. So I think this is a question where we have done, I think, a good job of keeping our allies and others on, with us. We don't have any dissension or question as to what EPA is and what it does. Our NATO allies are enormously appreciative that we have deployed it so quickly and that they are protected, the southern tier is protected from Iranian short and medium range. So I mean, that's all very, very good. So we don't have any question that what it is, and we keep asserting it. So what do you do to move things forward? It's a conversation between the two principals. And I think that, you know, we'll see when, after the confirmation hearings, when we get a new Secretary of Defense and new Secretary of State, when the President is able to actually begin traveling internationally, and when he sits down with Mr. Putin for the first time, and when that conversation will be part of a very big conversation about many other things. But it's clearly something that I believe the President will talk about in his first conversation. And I think that we can move forward to do things that will build confidence, but at the same time, decisions on deployment will be made going forward. We have made agreements with countries on the deployment strategy in both 15 and 18, and we intend to keep those promises. And the whole question of whether 2B will be ready will really be up to Congress. Are they going to provide the money for 2B to be actually not only built but tested? Because we've also made a commitment in EPAA not to deploy anything that hasn't been tested. We've already done that in Fort Greeley. So I hope that answers your question, Tom.
Great answer. Yes, sir.
Yes, Bill Jones from Executive Intelligence Review. If you could say something about what possibilities there are for moving forward on this missile defense issue, because the Russian reaction, as you noted, has been to intensively modernize their nuclear system. They're, you know, going to fifth generation nuclear missiles. They're bringing back the Satan liquid-fueled rocket and modernizing this. And similar to what they did when the SDI was proposed by Reagan, instead of cooperation, they said we're going to overpower it with our nuclear missiles. And they're doing the same thing at this point. I think that's probably is one of the reasons why they're not interested in coming into any kind of an agreement at the present moment. But they are working on their own ballistic missile defense system. Although they've given up Barbala, they've moved to Voronezh, which is a more modern place. But what can we do concretely? Because we're telling the Russians what we're not going to do, and they're probably believing us. But any military planner who's looking at this equipment on the other side of the border knows other things can be put on top of it, which could threaten them. And so that the promises sometimes are not enough, especially because we haven't agreed to.
The system cannot be made into an offensive system. That's the simple fact. And you know, we keep saying it, and we hope that they'll get it, that they. You know, we've done things to prove it to them that is an unclassified world, and you know, it's been very clear that that's what we believe and that's what the allies believe. You know, the question here is, this goes back to the question of mutually assured stability. This is about changing the context of the relationship, changing the opportunity and the aspirations of the relationship.